What are the clear problems that NGOs have created in Kenya, based on your study?
There are benefits that are, as already pointed out, but there are also problems, especially in terms of dependence. There are problems, there are parts of Kenya where the dependency notion has developed, where people just sit around, they can't do anything on their own because expecting an NGO will come and invest in their area. But at the end of the day, when the NGO invests in the area, it comes in, 10, 15 years later, they're still the same. They're still the same because the NGO has to be sustainable, just to continue working in Northern Kenya, for example. If it finishes all the diseases in Northern Kenya, for example, rinderpest, or for example, yellow cause fever, or foot and mouth disease, or those other diseases, like pleuropneumonia. Pleuropneumonia affects cattle in Northern Kenya. If they eliminate bovine pleuropneumonia, if bovine pleuropneumonia is eliminated, then they'll have no sense of working in Kenya. So they have to sustain that. They work in percentages that allow them to be relevant.
This podcast came to be because I want to reignite discussions about Pan-Africanism. And the purpose is to plant seeds of unity and inspiration among Africans, both at home and in the diaspora. I believe we have come to the stage where our continent is more vulnerable than ever, and it's up to us to decide our fate moving forward. What we will come to realize, I hope, is that we're so much more alike than we're different. And this show is just a small contribution to the public discourse that is going on in Africa right now. My name is Soshima Iro, and this is the Pan-African Experience. On today's episode of the Pan-African Experience, I'll be speaking to Dr. Maurice Amotabe about his book, The NGO Factor in Africa, The Case of Arrested Development in Kenya. Dr. Amotabe is a professor of African Studies at the Technical University of Kenya. He has written extensively on history and African studies in several journals around the world. I am grateful and honored to have Dr. Amotabe on the podcast. Dr. Maurice Amotabe, welcome to the Pan-African Experience.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Okay, so you are a professor of African Studies at the Technical University of Kenya, and you wrote the book, The NGO Factor in Africa, The Case of Arrested Development in Kenya. And yes. I just wanted, can you tell us what prompted you to write this book in the first place?
Yeah, thank you very much for the introduction and for the question. The interest for me to write this book on the NGO factor in Africa was prompted by three major factors. One of the factors was the crisis in governance in Africa in the 1990s, which we were experiencing. So, and the third factor is that I benefited from a Ford Foundation program to go to America, to University of Florida, to do a course on governance. And the third factor was my PhD, which was a research on the role of NGOs in developing in Kenya. So I was incited and excited to have the opportunity and a Fulbright scholarship to go to America to do my PhD. And one of the things that interested me was the role of NGOs in developing in Africa. The understanding at that time was that NGOs had been in Africa for over 50 years, and yet despite the presence of NGOs on the continent, we still had problems. There was Action Aid, there was Plan International, there was Care International, there was Oxfam, there was all kinds of NGOs on the continent. Yet despite that presence, the continent still experienced the issues they were formed to actually fight against. Issues such as disease, eradication of poverty, empowerment of girls, women, and youth, issues of governance, issue of transparency and accountability, and matters of gender mainstreaming. They were all still in Africa, despite the years of working in Africa. Then as I carefully examined the whole notion, the whole idea of NGOs, I realized that despite their presence, the NGOs were actually part of an industry. And the industry was predicated on donor support and donation. And that there was a feeling I had at the very beginning that perhaps they didn't want to completely eradicate poverty and other problems in Africa, because if they did, then the whole notion of development NGOs will actually end. So as an industry, as they call themselves a third sector, they'll actually collapse if they're addressed under finished all the programs on the continent. So when I started to do this research, my supervisor, Professor Donald Crammy, allowed me the freedom to choose the NGOs I wanted to research on, because I got funding from various organizations to enable me to come to Africa, to Kenya, and conduct research in, I think I did about 1 year, collecting data and so on. So after defending my PhD at the University of Illinois and passed, and so I did the doctorate, I was approached by one of the leading publishers in the world, Routledge, who told me, can you publish your work, because your work is already being inquired about, and it's likely to have a very big impact on developing in Africa. So when Professor Molefi Asande, the editor of Routledge, approached me, I was able to put up the book, The NGO Factor in Africa, trying to advance the arguments I'd made in my thesis as a PhD student, that actually NGOs were not doing as much as they promised the world. And the understanding was that they promised the world many things. They promised to empower, they promised to empower women, youth and children, they promised to eradicate poverty in informal settlements, they promised to empower Africans to come out of disease and ignorance. And many of these things were still outstanding, even as many years later, when I was doing the research for the book. So it's as a result of this that I got motivated to do the book. And when the book came out in 2006, it had a very big impact. In fact, I received a check for, the first day I received a check for about $5,000 profit, that the my royalty, it was just 5% royalty. So when I got the $5,000 check, then I said, yeah, this seems like the book did very good sales, because my royalties, my contract was 5% of the amount sold for each book. So when I got the $5,000, then I said, yeah, it seems like the book was well-received, and $5,000 where I come from in Kenya is a lot of money. So as a result of this book, I was invited to many conferences, many workshops as keynote speaker. I was invited in Singapore. I was invited in Malaysia, in Indonesia, in India, in South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, even Kenya, Nigeria. Many countries invited me to talk about this NGO factor in Africa. And my argument remained the same, that despite many years of working in Africa, NGOs had not accomplished what they intended to do. And the two critical things stood out. They paid foreigners most higher salaries than local workers. Many of the leading NGOs in Africa still pay outside workers, whom they call expatriates, more salaries, higher salaries than local workers. They tend to hire CEOs from the West. Many CEOs of NGOs in Africa are either Europeans or Americans. And when they try to diversify, you'll find one Asian here and one African there. But most of the CEOs of the NGOs at the global offices and also in Africa, the so-called regional directors for Africa or Sub-Saharan Africa or West Africa or East Africa or Southern Africa, usually are white. And I discovered that the packages for white staff were more lucrative than African staff. The packages for white staff sometimes included the holidays for families. You know, the CEO, his wife or the spouse, and children, up to, I think, 4 children. They'll go for overseas trips for almost 2 weeks. And the amount they spend on those overseas trips or overseas holidays will actually amount to amount that will be very useful for a project like a school, like a water project and so on. So they spend colossal amounts of money. And then their offices were mainly in Africa, air-conditioned, whereas African offices were regular offices where you open the window when it gets hot, or open the window when it gets cold, and so on. Whereas for them, they were using air-conditioned offices, the red carpets, access almost to internet and everything, whereas African workers were not living similarly. Then when they traveled in the field, the NGO CEOs or officials who are white or from the north or from the west will travel in four-wheel vehicles, very well cushioned in four-wheel vehicles, spaced out for people, maybe a driver and a CEO, one of the officials in front and two at the back. But when Africans traveled, I noticed they traveled in a crammed up vehicles. One Land Cruiser carrying 4 white officials, one Land Cruiser carrying 8 African members of staff for the NGOs. I also noticed that when we went out to to workshops in Nairobi, in Mombasa, in Kampala, in Johannesburg. The white officials, NGO officials, were often booked in five-star hotels with four-course meals for breakfast, for lunch, and for dinner, whereas Africans were booked in less prestigious hotels where they were only booked in for bed and breakfast and given some small allowance to cater for their lunches and their dinners. So I saw variances. I saw differences in terms of how staff were treated. Then I also noticed that in terms of office space, Africans shared spaces. I visited many NGOs, and I won't mention the names because of confidentiality of the research material and under which I did the interviews, that the office spaces for Europeans were much bigger. They had a computer, had a printer, and water, you know, at the corner there. So they'll drink the water. And so whereas Africans were sharing spaces, you'll find four or five people sharing space, a shared computer under local network. You'll find that papers will run out. They have to go and ask the white officials, sometimes even the same level, same rank. So these were discrepancies I found in the work environment. And then the health coverage was also different. In Nairobi, for example, many white expatriate employees of NGOs would be treated in what we call exclusive private hospitals, like Nairobi Hospital, like the Aga Khan Hospital, Mpisha Hospital, and so forth. Whereas Africans are referred to the government hospitals, like Kenyatta National Hospital and so on. The health coverage was different. The insurance for Africans was different from the insurance for white workers and so on. So these issues made me very uncomfortable, and I thought that I should write about them in this book. So if you look at the book, many of the things that I espouse are predicated on actual interviews with the white managers or program officers, African program officers, and people from other races and so on. I also realized that as I researched on this book, I discovered that even the issue of allowances, daily allowances, were different. Africans were paid $50, for example, per day as out of pocket or night out, whereas white officials, white members of staff, will be paid like $100 or $200 and so forth. So there are various discrepancies in this. And then promotions were also predicated on what one can call a racial bias, where many white employees were in their 20s and 30s, and we found that they're already at a higher level, what they call managerial positions. Whereas Africans with more experience, with more qualifications, remained at a local, what they call support staff, assistant program officer, assistant program manager, assistant this and that. Whereas white officials, even with the less experience, were always at the top of the pyramid in terms of this ranking and so on. Then I also noticed that during the budget sharing and so forth, there were certain hidden costs that did not actually reflect in the actual budgets they declared. And they were hidden because many of the programs they founded in Africa spend more money on salaries and capitation of these individuals traveling and so on than actually the actual programs. So if they sang a borehole, for example, in Turkana, if they sang a borehole in Isiolo or in Kitui, you found that actually the cost of the borehole was most of the time, if you look at the cost of the borehole, most of the time you'll find that the borehole will cost much less than the finances for example, one program officer traveling abroad who is white and so forth. So you found out that the overall output of the NGO funds in Africa, almost three quarters went back to Europe in allowances, salaries, and so on to this staff, and only about a third to maybe half remained in Africa to fund African development programs. I also found out there's a lot of what one can call a duplication. They all worked on similar programs. For example, poverty and empowerment programs in Kenya, for example, are done by Plan International, they're done by World Vision, they're done by Action Aid, they're done by Oxfam, they're done by Care International. So you found that if they are doing a gender mainstreaming, they'll converge on accounting with a lot of money spent in workshops, seminars, colloquia, and so forth, without necessarily going into the practical elements in terms of how to do empowerment, like microfinancing, very little was done in terms of that. Then training opportunities, capacity building. Many white employees found themselves being sponsored to do a lot of capacity building training in financial management, in governance management, efficient governance, efficient monitoring and evaluation, and so forth. Whereas Africans were confined to what one can call less prestigious programs in terms of training. White officials of these NGOs travel abroad. They'll travel to Paris, they'll travel to London, to New York, and so on. And whereas African employees were confined to local travel to Kumasi, to Accra, to Takoradi, or to Nairobi, to Isiolo, to Mombasa, to Dar es Salaam, Tabora, and so on. Then the other factor that I found critical in the research that I espoused in this book was that the overall development index of NGOs are not gone up. Whereas the government capitation, GNP and GDP funds increased since independence, like in Ghana, GDP allocations and Kenya allocations at independence, you found that government expenditure items were increasing systematically. Every year, the budget will go up. But the NGO budgets went up, but the output project outcome remained the same. They remained the same in terms of where they operated. They remained the same. They trained the same offices. They expanded some staff occasionally. But when they did, you didn't see that impacting on the actual field experience. So my thinking was that NGOs needed to do more in terms of engaging the stakeholders, indicator governments, in terms of what gaps should they fill. Because they came back, they came to Africa already with a predicated notion that Africa was underdeveloped, with a predicated notion that Africa needed help. And when they came in, they did not come in to chip in when a government was not doing enough, but they picked areas which were already predetermined from back home. They came in assuming that African women are disempowered and they require empowerment, and they not support the government programs of empowerment and so on. They came in believing that African men or societies do violence against women, so they'll come in with a program of eradication of violence against women in Africa. They'll come in with a program of maybe diseases, tropical diseases like malaria, typhoid, Kalazar, and so on, all those diseases. And they'll come in with the prepared notions and visions on how to address these and disregard all the other stakeholders who are doing, whether they were governments or local CBOs, and so on. Then the final aspect that the book highlights, and which I think is important, is that some of the ideas of NGOs were using Africa as experiments. I noticed that many of them were coming to Africa with the medical programs, with the vaccinations that were free. But at the end of the day, you discover that these vaccinations were being tested on Africans. The Africans were basically being used as guinea pigs. Even some of the development models, for example, the action based research, what they would call action research and so on, were basically using African societies as a guinea pigs in terms of whether the models can succeed or not. And as soon as the models succeed in Africa, they now take them back home. So the one for vaccines, I experienced that. Many vaccines came in as donations and so on. But you discover that as time went on, you discover that these vaccines, for example, from the 60s, when they were testing yellow fever vaccines in Africa, the first yellow fever vaccine in Africa was done in three countries in the world. The yellow fever vaccine was discovered in America by an American scientist, but the first three countries to experience yellow fever vaccine was Uganda, Kenya, and Ghana. And when the vaccine proved successful, they now went to apply that yellow fever vaccine in Europe and so on. So you could see that Africans were basically receiving this NGO money, but the name was vaccines, but they were actually being used as experiment guinea pigs. So, and this goes on to, in terms of some of the program areas. They come with the software, they come with all manner of experiments to experiment on Africa, and once that succeeds, then they take back home. One other experiment was a research on wheat production, for example, in Africa. When the wheat proved successful, it was taken to countries like Ukraine, Romania, it was taken to America, in California, and other places. But the places where the wheat was dried out in Africa and so on, did not get the improved seeds and all that. And this still goes on, for example, in the GMOs, these genetically modified products, for example. Many of those seeds were tested out in many parts of Africa. And when they found that these potatoes were not harmful to human beings, were not bringing in the cancers and the tumors that they imagined they would do, then they were taken to places like Idaho, where the potatoes are now being produced by McDonald's, Burger King, and so on. So you find that many of the crops are first tested in Africa. Even the improved breeds of livestock, even the improved breeds of chicken, for example, once they're tested on African populations and they find that they are harmless, then they can be taken back home for consumption by the actual human beings. Once they are seen to be of no harm, then they are taken back to the home countries. So there's a way in which governments in Africa, I was recommending, need to negotiate with NGOs so that NGOs come in all in areas of need, in areas of filling up important gaps of development, and not just being allowed to come in and settle in and mount any project they wanted. But as I say that, allow me to also point out that NGOs, I've done a good job, and I list in my book some of the benefits of NGOs. I've pointed out that they have created programs where governments do not operate. For example, they have created water programs. There are many parts of Kenya today which have water, borehole water or piped water or water from dams and so forth, which has been done by NGOs. Those areas won't have had that water without NGOs. There are also areas in Kenya which never had good schools, but NGOs like ActionAid, Oxfam, Wild Vision, Care International moved in and put up good classrooms. They put up good infrastructure. There are places which are done now hospitals, like in Wamba, Northern Kenya, in Lodwa, in Maralal, in many parts, like Isiolo. They didn't have hospitals, but NGOs have moved in. They have put up very good medical centers, or hospitals, health centers, and clinics. There are also many people who have benefited from scholarships by NGOs. I am a beneficiary of a scholarship by NGO. Ford Foundation funded my study in University of Florida. I also received a Fulbright scholarship to go and study for my PhD in America. And the external funding that came in for my research, I was funded by Rockefeller Foundation. I received about $25,000 to fund my PhD research in Kenya. So there's no doubt that NGOs have played a very important role in the empowerment of African states and so on. So we cannot fold them proud, but there are certain benefits which they have brought to Africa, but we are just saying that they have not done enough, that they could have done more with the kind of allocations that they have received from donors, from the home countries and so on. I also point out that there are many areas where we had good roads that NGOs chipped in. We also have improved livestock in many parts of Africa, which as a result of NGOs trained vets and pre-vets and even scouts. So there are many benefits that NGOs have brought to Africa, but my argument is that NGOs can do more. They can do more than they have done, and that they need to consult with stakeholders at the local level, with the governments, local governments, with the national governments, you know, to make things better for the African people and so on. And that they should stop this idea of using Africans as guinea pigs in development and allow technology to flow naturally instead of dumping. I want to give the example of computers which are old in many of Western universities, Western organizations and so on. Many of them are refurbished and sent back to Africa. When they come to Africa, they look like they're okay, they're new, but Africa basically is serving as a dumping ground for this obsolete technology. So you find they bring computers to Africa, which have just been refurbished. After 2-3 years, they become obsolete and they dump them on the African continent. So they leave their spaces intact out of these pollutants and so on. And this goes on just for other products as well. When you get any secondhand thing, whether it's a vehicle, whether it's a computer and so on, you're basically moving towards the dumping ground, that many of the products are actually almost at the expiry end before they're transferred to Africa. So you find that they're using this indirectly to dump some of these things to Africa. I know NGOs in Africa dispute clothes, for example, for the poor. Many of those clothes are secondhand from the West. So instead of going to their dump sites in the West, they bring them to Africa as aid and so on. So there are certain advantages that come with these as a result of this dumping mentality. The other day, we saw negotiations in Somalia, for example, for dumping what one can call active uranium materials and so on were being dumped in Somalia and other places in Africa. So they are buying basically spaces to come and dump those things, and they know that the dangerous emissions that will come with, out of those soils, and those soils will be killed forever as a result of these dangerous materials which they're dumping in Africa. This research done by, I think, a scholar, I can't remember his name, in Somalia, where they sold out thousands and thousands of acres which are being dug, and they dump these materials there. But the materials are dangerous, and they'll impact African soil. If they can get into water systems, they might actually poison peoples in Africa and so forth. So the issue of any geofacts in Africa must be looked at very carefully, because now we have even imported diseases, because the GMOs came to Africa. Now we are seeing increasing elements of cancer among children, cancer with people in 20s and 40s, because they're consuming food from those known brands like Kentucky Fried Chicken or the KFC, McDonald's, Burger King are now in Africa. And Africans are now getting diseases that were never in Africa, because Africans ate lean food. And many Africans were not fat people. They were very lean because of the kind of diet they pursued. But NGOs have come with the schemes to increase fruit production, but fruit production is killing some parts of Africa, where you find young children are so obese, they can't even fit in doors. I was privy to a case in one of the Kenyan schools where a door was supposed to be enlarged because one of the kids could not fit the door when they were running out and so on, because he was too fat out of these KFC, McDonald's, French fries, you know, and so forth.
You know, I just wanted to say that obviously the role of developing Africa or developing African countries should lie squarely on the shoulders of, you know, African governments and African leaders. You know, however, if these NGOs, you know, parade African children on the television here, you've seen that in America as well, you know, as a tool, as a fundraising tool, if they parade African kids on the media as a fundraising tool, then they should have the responsibility to use those funds raised with African kids in Africa. They should make sure they use those funds and implement change in Africa, because that's what they advertised to potential donors, you know, with the kids. And in your book, I just wanted us to delve into values and motives. Now, you know, in your book, you examine the value and motives of NGOs through the lens of imperial and capital interest. You know, and you argued that despite many years of working in Kenya and other African countries, there are a few cases has been like very little development, which is what you reiterated earlier. But I just wanted you to elaborate on the imperial and capital interest.
Right. Thank you very much for that question. The interesting aspect which you raised in your question is the penetration points, areas of penetration for Western capitalism. You find that NGOs will begin projects in the village to empower women, for example, entrepreneurship and so on. But once they begin to thrive and succeed, they'll now get an investor who will come and take advantage and potential of the crops they're producing, for example, now to process them. So women have been empowered to grow coffee, to grow tea, but they now get an investor who comes now to help them process that tea and export. So the final beneficiary of this project will be this investor who comes in, because he now makes the value addition and maximizes in terms of profit. So the women group has worked very hard to buy land, to grow coffee or tea or cocoa, but now the investor comes in now to export for them and give them little money from those. So the role of NGO becomes therefore the one of penetration, that they're penetrating the African market. And then they come in and say that now these girls require tampons, they require sanitary pads. And this is a very, very important project. So they begin to fund, and then the government says, we'll chip in, instead of just NGOs funding this sanitary pads project, we'll get in. Then they tell you, wait for a minute. Now the government is interested. We can show you who can import these standard pads. These pads bring them from UK or from US. So the issue here is penetration. Then they come and say, you people have great potential for fish. You have great rivers. You have a lot of estuaries, you know, rivers and streams. Why don't you dam these rivers and put some fish, get some, grow some tilapia? So the moment you begin to grow that tilapia, then they tell you, you know, the problem you have experienced now, we realize is a market. We need the export market is very big out there. We'll bring you an investor, and they bring the investor from their home country. The investor comes from their home country. So you find that many areas of investment, there's always counter penetration, even hospitals. Hospitals, when they hospitals pick up, there are more patients visiting, then they tell you now you need equipment. These are big hospitals now, you require big equipment for X-ray, for all kinds of, you know, and then they tell you where the machine comes from. The machine now has to come from the home country. Then they tell you, leave this electro supply from water, hydropower, and so on. Right now, the in thing is solar. You need solar. So people test solar. The people in the village say, solar is so efficient, solar is so good, so the solar never goes out. Then they tell you, you need bigger panels to generate for the whole village or whole town. But we'll take you where to buy the solar panels properly, come to our country. UK will give you the best price for solar panels. So you see the NGO counter-penetration and penetration. So they become conduits of capitalist infiltration in our countries.
I was wondering, what models of development and agenda setting do NGOs use in Africa, based on your studies?
Initially, before independence, they were using modernization theory. Modernization allowed them to assume that we'll go through stages through which Europe went through or America went through. So they tried to take Africa through the stages which Europe went through or America went through, saying that there'll be various stages of existence. And this is expounded by a scholar called W.W. Rostow, R-O-S-T-O-W. Rostow's model was very much used by NGOs, saying that now Africa will reach a point where they'll be coming from peasantry to modernization, they'll reach a point of takeoff, and then from takeoff, there'll be industrialization and so on. But those experiments didn't work out because Africa had a very different dimension in terms of growth and so forth. Then they came up with this action research participation or what they call grounded in participatory development. They give Africans models of development and allow them to use those models of development as done in the West and so on. That also didn't work out. And then the more recently, they have had this grassroots development approach, the bottom up as opposed to top down. They were saying the top down was dictatorial, that belonged to Mobutu Sese Seko, it belonged to dictators in Africa. They should allow people in the grassroots to decide. So they replaced top down models with the bottom up models, which also did not work. The World Bank came up and IMF came up with that during the social adjustment programs, and they didn't work at all. So you realize that they now have hybrids. What they have today is hybrids borrowed from Sweden, Denmark in terms of welfare, as well as pure capitalist pursuits from Britain, America, and so on. So you see NGOs, you talk to them today, what's your model of development? They are basically using hybrids through experimentation.
You know, in your book, you wrote about the paradoxes and ambiguities and suspicions held against NGOs in Kenya. You know, can you elaborate on this, please?
Yes, the paradox is where NGOs come with models which have worked elsewhere, and then they impose them on African countries. And some of the models did not work, for example, irrigation schemes, which they started like Pekera in Kenya and so on, and which collapsed as a result of not understanding African cultures, African prioritization of security crops, such as cassava, such as yam, such as sweet potato, so they ignored some of the African crops and basically imposed their own crops. So in many areas, this did not work because they didn't take into consideration the African priorities and so forth. The same to improvement of livestock. When they came in with these great cows, exotic breeds from the West and so on, many of them died from local diseases like nagana, like rinderpest and so forth.
You know, you also challenged the assertion that have presented NGOs as undifferentiated and homogeneous, faultless and pure. You know, you believe that NGOs' activities can also undermine development efforts. You used Rockefeller Foundation and its work in Kenya as a case study. And can you talk a little bit about Rockefeller Foundation, activities in Kenya with regards to agriculture, education, health sectors, and how these have undermined development efforts in Kenya?
What happened to the Rockefeller experiments was that many of them ended up benefiting the West. For example, the yellow fever vaccination was a very good health program, but there was a discovery that many Africans in Kenya were used as experiments, almost the guinea folds in the medicine, the yellow fever discovery. Agriculture, the same thing. The big experiment farm in Akuru, in Njoro, where they did wheat planting and so on. The wheat variety that was improved in Kenya was taken and used in America, but that wheat variety was taken to Australia and other parts of the world, Ukraine and so on, but that wheat was never grown in Kenya. So Kenya was only used for experimental purposes. But once the seeds that were useful in resisting rust and so on were taken out of Kenya, Kenya never received that back. So those were experiments done in Kenya, but the actual beneficiaries were outside Kenya. That's the argument.
Okay, so and I was wondering, because of the imperial aspects you have pointed out in your books, if there's any correlation between NGOs in Africa as we currently know it today versus the early missionaries in Africa in terms of exploitation or in terms of any other elements you found in your studies?
They are very similar in operation. NGOs and missionaries are very, very similar in operations. And that's why, if you look at my book, The NGO Factor in Africa, is actually partnered alongside the missionary factor in Africa. And I coined my title of the book, The NGO Factor in Africa, to the one of Oliver Rowland. His book is called The Missionary Factor in Africa. The Missionary Factor in Africa by Roland Oliver is very similar to my book, The NGO Factor in Africa. And if you look at the Roland Oliver's model and my model, are very similar in terms of approach. The Roland Oliver's model, the missionary factor, missionaries were used to penetrate the interior of Africa. The NGOs now are used to penetrate some parts of Africa, which they then allow capitalism to thrive. So there's a partnership, there's a correlation in terms of missionaries and also NGOs.
Okay, so there's also that element of the terms used by NGOs, such as field, which you believe are loaded with, patronizing, othering tendencies.
Right,
so,
I agree.
Such as, us versus them, backwards right. versus developed. What do you mean by this? Can you talk a little bit?
Yes, I agree with you that some of the NGOs' terminologies tend to be condescending when they begin to regard Africa as a field. When they come from London, you talk to them, they say that I'll be going to the field next week, meaning they're coming to Africa. So they basically use Africa as a field. So they describe many African parts of Africa as field. Then when they come to Nairobi, for example, they describe any area outside Nairobi as outside. We'll be moving outside Nairobi, we'll be going to the field, we'll be going to... So they regard the terms used are very condescending to describe those spaces as non-entities, as non-existent, as spaces that require to be recovered. They need to be civilized, they need to be cultivated, they need to be modernized and so on. And even the kind of engagement is us versus them. That, us back home, this is what you do. When you go to those workshops, you hear terms like, in Europe, this is what you'll get. In Africa, this is what you get. In Europe, the healthcare system is well advanced. In Africa, we're trying to help you to advance the healthcare system as well. So that comparative paradigm, they keep on shifting and putting capacity building workshops are almost always condescending. So in a way, they don't regard Africans as partners, but actually as less entities that require to be civilized and to be modernized.
I think you've touched on this topic that I'm about to ask you now before, but I know my understanding from your book is that you believe that NGOs are variously used by governments and international institutions of development to link communities to global social and economic movements in order to exploit them? You know, how?
Right.
How?
Yeah, that's the point. For example, when you create a impetus for investment in rural areas, then you bring in water pumps that are not made in that country, that are not made in Kenya. For irrigation purposes, you put in water pumps that are imported, and you take this, the amounts paid for those water pumps is not commensurate with the global pricing. You find that this money is meant to go back. So what a water pump on the open market from China or from Japan will cost on average about $2,000 to $4,000. But when you bring them from Europe, you'll pay $7,000, $8,000, even $10,000. So you find that the interest is to take this money back to home as much as possible. So on paper, you allocated the money, but in practice, the money actually is siphoned back. It goes back. When you're keeping in the office, you'll find that you need computers. The cheap computers will come from Japan and South Korea, for example, where a computer will cost you like $200. But you're told, you know, you have to buy them from US for $500 or UK for $600. So where the NGO comes from, where the headquarters is. So at the end of the day, on the balance of things and so on, you find the money actually goes back. And at the end of the day also, the African person in Kenya or in Ghana is now incorporated into this global sphere. When this computer runs out, it gets old, you'll go and buy wine from UK or US, or even a software. You'll have to put in a word, a program from US, for example. So you find that he's now tethered, he's actually enslaved and ensnared as a result of this initial technology. He's a water pump, his spare parts are a problem, you have to order them from the mother country and so on. So NGOs become, therefore, forms of penetration using capitalism. And then the capitalism funds them as donation, but once you are entrenched into that trade, you find that now you have to go for the seeds, which they gave you now. When they run out, you have to import those seeds from them because they helped you do the experiment, but they are now begin to selling to you that particular seed and all that.
You know, I agree with you in the notion that obviously the activities of NGOs in Africa is never there to fix the problem. They are there to assist the poor, but never to fix the problem, because obviously fixing the problem will make the whole business model obsolete. And in the UK here, there's been several news stories about how the head of NGOs are taking salaries in the hundreds and hundreds and thousands of pounds.
Right.
And, to that extent. And the fact that they're using, you know, for example, here in the UK, sometimes you see like an advert from a charity that shows African kids, this kid has been working for 5 to 10 miles every day to fresh water, you know, donate money so that we can help alleviate this issue. But then in the next 3-5 years, you see the same video of a kid still walking like, maybe now he's walking like four miles a day to fresh water. So there's not really a substantial improvement in the situation of that kid. But he has been used to generate, you know, in most cases, more than 60 million pounds, more than 100 million pounds, based on the video of that kid, has generated that amount of money. Yet, a very minuscule amount of that money goes into that community, you know, and that is exactly what I can deduce.
So it's almost exploitation.
Yes, yes.
To raise the money. I agree with you. So it's exploitation. It's exploitation by using these pictures, these videos of these poor people, to bring in money. We have seen in Kenya, for example, they use the Maasai. The Maasai picture is very popular to showing poverty, half naked men, half naked women, and so on, Turkana and all that, to get money, to get sympathy. They bring in a child without food or with the flies all over the face in order to generate sympathy. But once the money arrives here, the beneficiaries are those NGO officials and not the local persons.
Okay, so what are the clear problems that NGOs have created in Kenya, based on your study?
There are benefits that are, as already pointed out, but there are also problems, especially in terms of dependence. There are parts of Kenya where the dependency notion has developed, where people just sit around, they can't do anything on their own because expecting an NGO will come and invest in their area. But at the end of the day, when the NGO invests in the area, it comes in, 10, 15 years later, they're still the same. They're still the same because the NGO has to be sustainable, just to continue working in Northern Kenya, for example, if it finishes all the diseases in Northern Kenya, for example, rinderpest, or for example, yellow cause fever, or foot and mouth disease, or those other diseases, like pleuropneumonia affects cattle in Northern Kenya. If they eliminate bovine pleuropneumonia, if bovine pleuropneumonia is eliminated, then they'll have no sense of working in Kenya. So they have sustained that. They work in percentages that allow them to be relevant.
Okay, so, you know, and the critical question now remains that how do we eliminate these negative impacts of NGO in Africa, you know?
I think it's partnership. I think my understanding of that is partnership. Creating positive partnership between CBOs or local community-based organizations and government, and sharing stakeholder evaluation in terms of which areas are needy than NGOs coming and imposing themselves on their own preset agenda. That the agenda setting should be done jointly between the NGOs, government, and local communities. If the agenda setting is done jointly, then they'll actually address gaps. Then right now, when they're duplicating their services, their roles in various areas, but if the agenda setting is done jointly, then they'll be told that what we need is water in this area. And in this other area, what we need is education. And in this other area, what we need is agriculture, empowerment in this other area. In this other area, we need to eliminate FGM. If FGM is eliminated, girls go to school, girls will not die while giving birth because of circumcision and so on. So the agenda setting needs to be discussed jointly by all the stakeholders.
Okay. That's very interesting to hear from you. So I just wanted to say, before we end the interview, is there anything else you would like to add to this discussion that maybe I did not ask you?
Yes, I think our regional organizations like ECOWAS, like the East African Community, IGAD, African Union, they need to have engagement with the NGOs as they come to Africa. Like South Sudan now, Juba has very many NGOs working in various areas. So the regional organizations and governments, they need to be proactive in terms of directing the NGO resources in relevant areas, and they channel them to needy areas than just this idea of duplication. Like South Sudan now, if you go to Juba, the NGOs working on empowerment programs for Nuer or Dinka or Shiluk women, you find that 3-4 working on the same thing for schools for them. They are paying fees for them in refugee camps in Kenya, for example, when actually they could diversify. One can work on the mining, another one can work on education, another one can work on supply of water, another one can work on the construction of roads, and so on. So thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, Dr. Maurice Amutabi, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Subscribe to our YouTube channel, The Pan-African Experience. Join us on Facebook at The Pan-African Experience. Follow us on Twitter, TPA Experience. And follow us on Instagram, The Pan-African Experience. Visit our website at www.thepanafricanexperience.com.